Hello, I'm here with Professor Anne Sanson, and it's January 2017, and it's a bit of an overcast day, and Anne has agreed to have a chat about her experience working to promote peace in the world. And thanks, Anne, for joining us today.
You're very welcome, Sarah.
So we've got some questions which we just wanted to get your take on and share your experience with our members. So the first question we were wondering is, can you just tell us about how you came to be involved in the field of peace psychology and what motivated you?
Sure. So I've been sort of a bit involved in this area for longer than I care to remember. But I've always said that having a social conscience is one of the most inheritable things you can have, that there is. My parents were always concerned about social justice issues. Mm-hmm. So I always grew up with ideas and concerns about the social issues of the time. And then jumping ahead to when I was doing my PhD at La Trobe, had two young children, I was fairly busy, but the two issues that I was really passionate about were the rights of Aboriginal people mm-hmm. and nuclear war, because this is in the early 80s, at a time when the threat of nuclear war was very high. You know, we were a minute to midnight with the superpowers having their arsenals aimed at each other, and it was very scary. But I was saying, well, I've got two young kids and I'm doing my PhD and I'm teaching, I'm too busy, I don't have time to do it. And then just as I was coming to the end of that, a very charismatic person, Connie Peck, at La Trobe, where I was, started getting very engaged in this issue and talking very passionately about it, and helped to develop, came up with the idea of developing an interest group of psychologists, what was then Psychologists for the Prevention of War.
Mm-hmm.
That was a great place for me to slot in with my energy and interest in the area. And I guess even then a real concern for me was the future of kids. I'm a developmental psych, and my research area was with young children, and we were very aware of the fears that young kids had at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Kids were telling us that, you know, they were really scared that it was affecting their ideas about the future, whether it was worth putting any energy into a future when it was so uncertain. And very little was being done about any of that. So it was really my love for the planet and my concern about humanity and particularly the next generation of kids growing up.
And how old were the children who were saying these things?
Oh, ranging in age from sort of four to...
Oh, four?
Yeah, so the kids who were believing that their neighbours had the bomb under their beds.
Oh, gosh.
There were kids who were scared when planes flew overhead. There had been a number of sort of apocalyptic films on the possibility of a nuclear war and global winter that would have followed from that, and the possibility of annihilating human civilization was very real at that time,
mm-hmm.
and annihilating basically all life on the planet. So it was really a scary time, and there were so many psychological issues as we started to think about it. Like, you know, I think 89% of the Australian population said they were in favour of nuclear disarmament. They were really concerned about it.
Mm-hmm.
But only about 10% had ever done anything about it. Mm-hmm. Had written a letter, had gone to a march, written, you know, contacted their politician, anything like that. So that was really interesting. Why can people be...
Mm.
How is it that people can be so concerned about something and yet not feel any sense of personal responsibility?
Did they feel powerless? Is that why? Or?
Yeah, well, we did some research on that, what was stop people from being active.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a whole range of things, the powerlessness, lack of self-efficacy, not believing a single person can make any difference.
Mm-hmm.
It was all the usual things, not enough time, what will the neighbours, my friends and neighbours think of me if I start to become a radical, that it's not quite respectable to be an activist.
Oh, so that was aligned with radicalism.
Well, yes. Well, being an activist was, you know, a bit unruly and getting out there on the streets and all those stereotypes.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you're right, the self-efficacy thing was a major thing. What can one person do?
Mm-hmm.
So right from the start then, one of the things that we were always saying was quoting Edmund Burke, who said, "Nobody made a greater mistake than he who did nothing because he could only do a little," and really trying to talk about how people together can make a difference. I guess the other thing was that it made people scared to think about it, so it was much easier just to deny it,
mm-hmm.
ignore it, put it aside.
Mm-hmm.
So our message there was that the best way of dealing with anxiety is to do something to address the cause of it.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so really those were the things that motivated me to get involved.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Connie Peck and a bunch of other people were the inspiration for a lot of us at that time.
Mm. So that explains your involvement in the Australian Psychological Peace Interest Group.
It does a bit, yeah. Well, I became involved in the group from when it was formed. So it was one of the very first interest groups of the Australian Psychological Society.
Mm-hmm.
And at our peak, we had like 900 members. I think one in five members of the APS was a member of what was then PPOW.
When was that? We had so many people.
Probably in the late 80s. So I took on various roles. I was state coordinator for a while. And then when Connie moved on to do other things, I became national convener for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And we started these projects that took a lot of energy but were very rewarding,
mm-hmm.
and fun, like designing a calendar for every year, a poster calendar,
mm-hmm.
and this was the time when everybody had posters up on their, you know, toilet doors and along the corridors and things. They were very popular, so we would produce them on a number of them on our model of conflict resolution, the Wise Ways to Win model that a number of people developed. And so different facets of that model that we developed. We sat around my kitchen table or other people's kitchen table for hours and hours designing things and getting good graphic artists and cartoonists to illustrate it and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then a huge amount of energy into selling them,
mm-hmm.
And distributing them widely. So that was one of the activities we did that was really rewarding, and because it was an annual thing, it just kept us motivated to keep on doing it.
Mm.
You know, we couldn't sit back on our laurels. We were on to doing the next one as soon as we'd finished one. But there are a whole lot of other projects too. So one that I was quite involved in was the Letters to Leaders project.
Yeah, when was that?
So I think that was 1986, which was International Year of Peace.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, the Victorian government had set up a Peace Education Resource Centre and was supporting teachers to be incorporating peace education into the curriculum in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
So we worked with them and with other people to get this project going in inviting kids to write letters to a world leader of their choice about their hopes and fears for the future.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a massive response. It was the time when Reagan was president of the US and Gorbachev was the head of the USSR, and most of the kids chose to write to one of those two people,
mm-hmm.
but other people were writing to Bob Hawke, who was the Prime Minister at the time, or to, I think, was it Maggie Thatcher? I can't remember, but to various different politicians, and writing these very moving letters. So we had 86,000 kids writing letters.
Gosh, what was the age range of the...
From primary to through secondary, it was mainly primary school kids.
Okay.
And sometimes teachers would arrange to have every kid in the class who wanted to writing a letter. Others, just a few kids did, and they wrote poems and they did pictures. And
Wow.
We had a huge great ceremony at the GPO, post office in town, with a number of ambassadors coming and receiving their great big mail bags of letters to their, to their head of state. So it was lots of fun and got quite a lot of publicity, and we produced a series of posters with some of the messages that the kids were telling us about their fears, saying things like, it's a big fear for a little person. And other things like, you know, you tell us to solve our problems by talking, but look how you're solving your problems, you're threatening to blow up the world.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's our future and you're wrecking it for us. You know, very powerful messages.
Mm-hmm.
So that was another really good project. So it, you know, I guess then there was the end of the arms race, sort of. Not that we've solved the problem of nuclear weapons in the world, but the level of threat reduced a lot, and we then, our thinking sort of evolved to thinking about conflict resolution being important at all levels, not only internationally, but also in interpersonal relationships and intergroup relationships and so on. So a lot of our work from then on became sort of broader.
Mm-hmm.
And focused around conflict resolution as well as peace promotion, and, but the issues of racism and other things got incorporated as well. And so it goes, and the group continues on.
And you've maintained your commitment because now you're national secretary.
Am I?
Yes.
Oh. Yes, I am. but yes, so I've gone through periods of being more and less active, but I've always been a member and always. You know, being concerned to see it continue. So it's great that it is, that you're helping with these interviews, Sarah.
That's great, Anne. Thanks.
Should we see how that's actually working?